Tonight. All right, welcome back to this week's edition of the Ellison Report, your very own neighborhood magazine of politics, policy, and the people. Presented weekly on your radio dial and podcast link. We're here at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Excuse the sound of cough drops this week, fam. But I am your host and executive producer, Charles D. Ellison, at the WEAA studios on the storied campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. Find us at Ellison Report on Twitter. So as the battle over immigration morphs into a full-blown legal war and constitutional crisis, so-called sanctuary cities are right in the middle of it. And so far, taking a stand alongside migrant populations in an effort to block Trump administration executive actions. To talk more about that is Catherine Cullerton Gonzalez. She's a civil rights expert, voting rights lawyer, and she's senior counsel at New York-based think tank Demos. And you can get more detail about Demos at demos.org. I believe you can go to @Demos as well on Twitter. Do I have that right, Catherine?
It's actually @Demos_ORG.
There we go. @Demos_ORG. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm very glad to be on your show. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. Excellent. So you examined sanctuary cities in a Demos briefing entitled Sanctuary, Safety, and Community, Tools for Welcoming and Protecting Immigrants Through Local Democracy. That's the title. How much power do cities and other local communities really have in pushing back against recent Trump actions and plans on immigration?
Yeah, that's a great question, Charles. I mean, a lot of cities have more power than they think they do, and yet the power is not unlimited. But as far as the United States Constitution goes, there are rights for local communities like Baltimore County or, which is a sanctuary county, to restrict their police from enforcing federal immigration law. And in fact, they should do so because to enforce federal civil immigration law can actually run the risk of constitutional violations, due process violations, and equal protection violations. And I was really glad to see the decision of the Ninth Circuit last night, which also underscores that, undocumented immigrants also have rights, and the presidential power is not unlimited. So the Ninth Circuit ruled against the Muslim ban last night, and I'm just very glad to see the basis of that, you know, temporary ruling was fundamental rights for every member of the community.
Right, that Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling basically showing the Trump administration that governing is very difficult, and also that those checks and balances are still there, they're still maintained. Now, you talk about local protections in that piece, but I'm wondering at what point is that limited if, and you did talk about just a few moments ago, you mentioned the limitations that cities have, the limitations that they may not know they have. So at what point are those limitations on stage if federal enforcement authorities step in? I guess I'm curious about the relationship between local and federal authorities on the issue. And also, what about the states? So I guess the relationship between states and the federal government, states and cities, you know, there's this sort of whole triangular dynamic there.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I love the way you put it because it's more triangular than a hierarchy, right?
Right.
So, we have a federal government that is trying to enact and do draconian measures to abuse its power and to force the local police to cooperate in its abuse of power. And so, it sort of depends on what it is that the federal government is trying to do. The states and localities do not have to cooperate with federal civil immigration enforcement. And the reason is because being undocumented is a civil violation. It's like failure to pay taxes. So there's no reason that local police should be involved in doing the federal government's work in enforcing civil immigration law. Also, local schools and institutions like hospitals and different state agencies, the DMV in Maryland has information about immigration status they do not have to share that with the federal government. Hmm. So those are some of the actions that can be taken, along with criminal justice reforms, to help to protect undocumented immigrants. I think that all of this is going to be playing out in court, unfortunately, and I'm very glad that there's a sanctuary movement, because the Trump administration has threatened to take away federal funding from cities like Baltimore and places around the country that the more than 400 places around the country that are sanctuary jurisdictions. But as my co-author and I wrote in our report, that power is also not unlimited, and those threats are overblown. So that's what you see the state attorney generals of New York and the state of California and the state of, and the city of San Francisco fighting back and saying, you cannot take our funding, because that would be a form of coercion by the federal government.
So, you know, maybe optically or rhetorically, those threats could be overblown, but couldn't it sort of prompt cities to think twice after a while? As far as their position on the immigration travel ban or immigration restrictions, so is it much more political than it is administrative or procedural or legal at that point? It's just cities. Are you worried about cities making a political decision based on the threats regarding federal funding? And then we've got the Trump administration talking about this $1 trillion infrastructure package at some point, and I know a lot of cities are salivating about that. So are you worried about that?
Yes, of course, but at the same time, we see more sanctuary cities than before. So cities are also reacting to you know, the needs of their residents and their constituents and immigrant communities and communities of color who don't want over-policing and raids that will impact everyone, that will tear families apart, that will ruin the economy, and that may also run the risk of constitutional violations. So I think there is going to be a legal battle, and there's a political battle. It's very important that, you know, the movement and the protests continue, that we in our communities want to welcome immigrants, we want to welcome refugees, and we will exercise our rights to do so, to protect them from abuse of power by the federal government. So that's, you know, the answer is that it is a political answer. It is a political issue, as well as a legal issue. But I think that, you know, I've been at Dulles Airport. I have colleagues who've been at BWI, been protesting these very draconian executive orders that are anti-immigrant and extremely discriminatory. And we're seeing a movement building that the people are just not going to put up with it.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Catherine, about a few moments ago in terms of the economies of those jurisdictions, economies in different cities and states. And, you know, I'd like to get your perspective on how the fate of migrant populations is so crucial to cities like Baltimore or like San Francisco, which did file suit against the administration. Beyond the clear moral and social and legal questions, if you can sort of lay out the economic calculus for cities here, why is it so important to make sure that those migrant populations are protected, you know, in terms of the economics, in terms of, you know, their economic viability?
Yeah, look, there's 11.4 million undocumented people in the United States today. And the reason they're undocumented is because our immigration system has been broken for about 20 years now. Is this generation of immigrants, you know, has a harder time becoming legal like prior generations. And this generation of immigrants that's more racially diverse is being targeted in a way that others have not been. But that's 11.4 million people, many of whom have been here for a very long time. And they're our family members. They're local business owners. They work in all kinds of capacities in our communities. And study after study after study has shown that immigrants actually contribute to local economies and take less benefits and make a higher contribution to our tax base and to our local economies more than United States citizens. So they create jobs for United States citizens. Back in the post 9/11 era, there were some towns that also thought that they should be enforcing federal immigration law, or we can take, you know, more recent examples like Alabama or Arizona, where, you know, Sheriff Joe or the anti-immigrant policies in Arizona that were overthrown by the United States Supreme Court because they were unconstitutional. In the meantime, local businesses suffered. Agriculture suffered. Many, many industries, construction, many U.S. industries are just very dependent on immigrant labor. Many of our own, many of the institutions of local government benefit from immigrants paying into the Social Security system, benefit by immigrants paying taxes when they buy things, and it keeps stores and restaurants and all kinds of local businesses open and thriving. So just to close the story, in the post 9/11 era, we saw towns like Trenton, New Jersey decide that they were going to enforce federal immigration laws, and it negatively impacted the economy. So they changed their minds. Their main streets were closing down. They changed their minds. And if you take a look around, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, any major city, you'll see that immigrants are revitalizing the local economy.
You know, which is ironic, too, how the newly implemented Attorney General Jeff Sessions is from a state where they tried this really dramatic anti-migrant law, and it failed spectacularly. I mean, if you want a case study in how an anti-immigration law or an anti-migrant law fails, you can pick out Alabama, right? And so it's just sort of ironic because I know now Attorney General Jeff Sessions is sort of viewed, or he's reported as sort of the godfather, the ideological godfather, if you will, of this anti-migrant push. But he's coming from a state where they tried it, and then they found out the hard way that they heavily rely on migrants. So it's very fascinating to watch a Republican administration and congressional Republicans who hype, sort of cast themselves as pro-economic growth to be so hard set, so stubbornly set against migrants who make these contributions to the economy. But I want to ask one last question too, Catherine. We've got about a couple more minutes. Could too much pushback from cities and states also shatter that delicate federalism, which is the glue holding the union together? Is there any worry that the friction here could trigger any larger political instability or crisis than we're prepared for?
I guess to answer your question, we actually advocate for a form of local democracy and states' rights that is based on the community, and it is based on principles of democracy and inclusiveness. And so, as a civil rights lawyer and as a person who's seen, states' rights being used against civil rights, I think it's very important that, this discussion and the way that it plays out is based on, principles of democracy and inclusiveness. I do think we're at a time of crisis in our nation and anything could happen, but if people are speaking up about our fundamental values and the majority of us, want to make sure that our democracy includes everyone and that this generation of immigrants is not mistreated.
All right. We've been talking with Catherine Culleton Gonzalez. She's a civil rights expert and voting rights lawyer, also senior counsel at New York-based think tank Demos. Go to demos.org or demos_ORG at Twitter for more information. Catherine, hey, listen, thanks so much. Keep us updated.
Okay, we will. Thanks for having us.
All right. It's a pleasure. Take care. Up next is Working Nation's Art Bilger on the coming era of automation and how that dramatically impacts the future of jobs. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from Island Press. More at islandpress.org. and from partners like BE Strategy. Strategy, research, communications. More at strategybe.com. There's not a whole lot of open discussion from legislators and policymakers about it, but automation, that technological advancement driven by innovations in computing science and artificial intelligence, is going to hit the global workforce hard in the next generation. And it might not be pretty. And, well, elected officials aren't ready for it either. Here to expound on that is venture capitalist Art Bilger. He's also founder and CEO of California-based Working Nation. For more information, go to workingnation.com and also at Working Nation on Twitter. Mr. Bilger, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Hey, thanks
for
much.
The opportunity.
All right, excellent. So there's quite a bit to tackle here, but at the top, you've argued that 47% of all jobs will be eliminated by technology in the next generation, I guess somewhere around like 2030 or 2040. Help us wrap our heads around that, because it sounds rather alarming.
Well, let me first say that I'm not so much the leader in that argument. That actually, those stats actually come out of a study that came out of Oxford not too long ago. So that's where those numbers come from.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're really looking at is we're looking at something like we've never seen before in our nation's history, and that is really four key variables coming together all at the same time. One, which we've heard a lot about over the last year and a half, is obviously globalization. That clearly has, you know, dramatically impacted employment here in the United States. But then another variable that is as dramatic, if not more dramatic, as we look forward, which is only now being discussed actively, and that is the whole area of just pure technology and automation, eliminating jobs. Not so much, you know, jobs aren't necessarily going to move offshore, but rather, you know, just disappear here as a result of technology and automation. The third variable is something which is a terrific thing, and that is longevity.
Mm-hmm.
We're expanding life expectancy dramatically through, you know, healthcare, you know, opportunities. But with that comes, you know, many units of labor staying in the workforce much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the fourth key variable is education. And when I refer to education, I'm speaking very broadly. And it is just not keeping pace with those other variables. And there we must make some dramatic changes. So that's what we're leading. We at Working Nation identified these issues going back, I guess I really started working very actively on this about 3.5 years ago.
Right.
But our goal here is not just to scare everyone,
right,
but it is really to then highlight where are the solutions, and that's what we're working on.
And what are the consequences of so many lost jobs? So, you know, some who are listening or who are thinking about this, you know, some of it might sound like science fiction, but how much social, economic, and political disruption can that cause? And are we seeing signs of that disruption today?
I think we're seeing signs of it today.
Mm.
If you look at, you know, when I walked out of a dinner that where a lot of this started, it was about 3.5 years ago. It was a dinner in New York. One of the big banks was holding, and it got me thinking about this.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I didn't have to look out 20 or 25 years as to, you know, major issues along these lines. But I must say I did walk out thinking I was looking out 5 to 10 years. This past summer, I finally started, you know, thinking and saying, as we all watched, the Trump and the Sanders movements build
right
in this country at such magnitudes that started saying to people, we don't have to look out to tomorrow. It's actually here today.
Hmm.
There are millions and millions of people in this country in pain, either directly in terms of their own households or, you know, looking at other family members, friends, et cetera, or just the, you know, just the fear of what will be next from their own job standpoint. So I think it's very much here today.
And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the 2016 election. I mean to cut you off, but I did want to ask if that many jobs would be lost to automation and artificial intelligence, also known as AI, why aren't policymakers and candidates, elected officials discussing or really doing anything about it? You can argue that they're nibbling around the edges of it a little bit, right? But when they talk about the disappearance of Rust Belt manufacturing jobs or the ubiquitous factory shutdown, they're not using the word automation. So do you think they're hitting these issues as aggressively as they could? I'm sure I know the answer to that, but what can they do when the rate of advancement is happening this fast?
Well, first of all, having watched the at the federal level, there, other than the concept of, you know, globalization and the offshoring of jobs, you really heard very, very little from either party on any of these other issues. And that is a problem. I've actually had the opportunity to speak with, you know, people in the federal government more recently, or those who are aspiring to be in the federal government. And, you know, they've asked me all kinds of questions about federal policy, and I'm clearly not an expert in federal policy. But the one thing I do say to them is you've got to speak directly to the issues, to the people of this country, because there are many things we can do, but we've got to accelerate the understanding. And, you know, the biggest, it's not the sole megaphone, but the largest megaphone is right there in, you know, sitting in Washington, and then every news reporter and others will pick up on that and spread the word. But to your point, very little was discussed during this past election cycle.
Where do you find that balance, I'm curious, between the obvious need for employment and society's insatiable appetite for more innovation? So it sounds to me that you would have to reduce technological innovation and some sort of effort to maintain adequate levels of employment. So where do the trade-offs occur, if any?
Well, first of all, I think there's something even before that, and that is we sit here today, for example, that there are many jobs that aren't being filled. And that is because, you know, the skill level of workers out there has not been developed appropriately for those jobs. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that, you know, going to the most dramatic point you're making in terms of, you know, disappearance of just, you know, endless numbers of jobs. But even before that, we have many jobs here. I remember a story that I heard, I guess this dates back to last May. I was listening to the CEO of Siemens Corporation, Siemens USA Corporation, speak at a conference out here in Los Angeles. And he was talking about how they were not able to fill many of the jobs at Siemens here in the U.S. as a result of you know, skills deficits of individuals. And they, Siemens, about a year and a half ago, created a apprenticeship program here in the United States to try to solve those issues. Now, Siemens has the advantage in that it has, you know, strong German ties, and apprenticeship is a very common concept there. And we've been talking very actively, and they've been very helpful to us. That type of concept of apprenticeship, internships, et cetera, are the types of things that could really boost up, and I'm talking about across society, you know, the bottom 20% and across, you know, the middle of society. It's things like that that can be done. You know, 50 years from now, you know, I'll be honest with you, I can't tell you what this looks like. But what I can tell you is over the next 20 years, there are many solutions that we can deal with before we have to sort of say no more technological development.
And what sort of conversation can you have with the technology sector about this? Because they seem somewhat oblivious to these trends. I don't know, maybe that's an incorrect way of characterizing it, but they seem oblivious with every new autonomous self-driving car or every planned delivery drone or every major announcement about some advancement in AI. So what role should they be playing?
Well, again, in this whole area of skill, understanding what the jobs of the future will be and skills-related activities, they can be doing a lot. You know, let me step back. I believe the solutions are largely at the local level. And it's corporations, it's not-for-profits, it's academic entities, and it's local government. It's not to say that federal, you know, tax policy and budget policy can't be influential. Of course they can. Course it can. But the solutions themselves are at the local level. So to your question, there are widespread activity of technology companies that are, you know, jumping in to, yes, they're developing things that might, you know, unfortunately, you know, eliminate jobs or clearly change the skill levels required for jobs. But at the same time, there are many of these companies who are then putting in an effort to retrain or create the opportunity to train people for these skills, young people. I'll give you an example. It's a company I was affiliated with a long time ago, a company called Akamai Technologies. Through Akamai, I learned about what they were doing, and they've created a program now where they are bringing young people in and training them in skills for the you know, the technology jobs of the future. They're also the ones who introduced me to a not-for-profit called how was it called? Girls Who Code, and it's, I think that was founded about 3 or 4 years ago. And there you have a wide range of technology companies creating, I guess it's summer internships for high school girls to, you know, go in and learn skills and then before they go off to college. And many of those girls who've been touched long enough ago, I'm told, are actually going in and now studying, you know, in college, studying computer science or whatever. So I do think you have the tech companies coming around to understanding the issues that are they are raising via their technological development and now trying to contribute to it. Now, at the same time, Girls Who Code, about when I spoke to them about 6 months ago, they had touched about 3,500 girls, I believe, in their life. Well, this ought to be 35,000 girls each summer.
Right.
And that's what we've really got to be. We've got to be scaling these things up dramatically.
All right. We've been talking with Art Bilger. He's a longtime media executive, and he's the founding CEO of Working Nation. It's a national campaign that's ringing the alarm about the growing skills gap in the United States. And you can find out more information at workingnation.com, at Working Nation on Twitter. Mr. Bilger, hey, listen, thanks so much. We've got to talk more about it.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on, and I look forward to speaking more.
Definitely. We'll be in touch. All right, next, it's Cato Institute's Neil McCluskey in our special Voices of K-12 segment on the pros and cons of Betsy DeVos here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from K-12, provider of online educational solutions. More at K-12.com. Also, don't forget about listeners like you who support efforts like this. Find out more about how you, too, can contribute at WEAA.org. Hint, click on donate. There was quite a bit of noise and tug of war on and off Capitol Hill this past week over the nomination and skin of the teeth confirmation of Michigan billionaire Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. Now that she's official, she's bona fide now, what does that mean specifically for the K-12 educational landscape? Joining us for our special Voices of K-12 segment is Neil McCluskey. He's director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Cato Institute. More at Cato, C-A-T-O.org, and at Neil McCluskey, that's N-E-A-L-M-C-C-L-U-S-K-E-Y, on Twitter. Neil, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, so this was obviously a very interesting week in Washington, and we've got many more of them to come, of course. But some unprecedented things happened. The confirmation of cabinet nominee by vice presidential tiebreaker, for one. And you even had some Republicans, even rank-and-file conservatives, appearing to align with Democrats on opposition to Ms. DeVos. So more curiously, however, is that this seemed to be over issues in K-12 education. What happened, Neil, to that spirited debate on the future of K-12 during the 2016 election? Now suddenly everyone seems to be so concerned about it.
Yeah, well, we didn't really hear a whole lot about K-12 education in the campaign because a lot of it was sort of settled at the end of 2015 when the No Child Left Behind Act was rewritten and is now the Every Student Succeeds Act. And there were a whole lot of people who were angry before that about federal overreach, No Child Left Behind. A lot of people didn't like how it labeled schools as failing and told them what it had to do to change. And then there was Race to the Top and Common Core and lots of things coming through the federal government. And kind of on a very bipartisan basis, people in Congress said, we need to end a whole lot of this. And so this Every Student Succeeds Act really kind of took the federal foot off the gas and said, you know, states and districts, we're going to return some power to you. And so there wasn't a whole lot of discussion about K-12 education in the campaign because a lot of it had been resolved, at least for the time being, which is what made the DeVos fireworks kind of surprising.
Is it so much about that issue being resolved, or do you, from your vantage point, do you see a situation here where lawmakers really don't have any not just lawmakers either, but the political parties and their candidates really don't have any collective idea on how to make American K-12 education work?
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. So I think there was consensus that the federal government shouldn't have been as prescriptive as it had been really since 2001 with the beginning of, or 2002 with the beginning of the No Child Left Behind Act. But what Betsy DeVos really represents is two things. One is she was talking about having the federal government potentially do even less. She talked a lot about federalism and and what the Constitution says the federal government can do, which is almost nothing, versus states and districts. And then the other thing was she has been actually heavily involved in education for decades, but it has been mainly in trying to get more school choice. Yes, that partially means charter schools, which are actually public schools, but they're kind of run by quasi-private entities, but also private school choice, like voucher programs and tax credit programs. And a lot of what the debate seemed to come down to was a referendum on whether or not school choice was a good thing or a bad thing. And then part of that was also, and is it something that should come from the federal government? I think most of the anger was from people who wanted to say, we do not support school choice, no matter where it comes from. We don't support school choice. And that's why it was often framed as this person would be bad for public schooling and hates public schooling and things like that. It's because she is for school choice, even though she didn't talk about trying to force it through the Department of Education.
So, and that brings me to that big question I know a lot of folks are trying to figure out now, and that triggered this whole debate over DeVos, is what does she mean for the future of American education? More specifically, you know, obviously K-12 education. So some would suggest from her supporters to her detractors that, you know, she's definitely going to do things much differently. There'll be a lot of disruption. Is that disruption for the good? Is it for the bad? I mean, what are you seeing here based on, and she's only been, what, a couple of days there, so we're not going to be able to tell for a while now.
Yeah, I actually don't think there'll be that much disruption. In part, that's because, again, the Every Student Succeed Act already changed pretty significantly the tenor of what the federal government had been doing in K-12 education.
Got it.
So we already saw a movement in law to make the federal government less intrusive, which is a lot of what she was talking about. Where it could be transformative is if not just the secretary, who doesn't have the power to do this herself, but the Trump administration were to say, well, we're going to try and spend a whole lot of money on private choice. And it's true that that candidate Trump talked about spending $20 billion federal dollars to, in some way or another, incentivize states to have more school choice. Could be charter schools, could be private schools. We're not sure of the mechanism, but he did talk about that. But that's not something that Secretary DeVos can do on her own or that the administration can do. That requires Congress. And in fact, Betsy DeVos said in her hearing that she couldn't push any sort of school choice without acts of Congress. Hmm. So she herself can't transform anything. Congress would have to do that.
I did want to ask you, I mean, what are those challenges in pushing that choice agenda? But in terms of region, state, city, I mean, there's a lot of different dynamics there in terms of the players, the stakeholders. I mean, you've got Congress, obviously, because, you know, she really can't do anything until Congress does something. But then how will different regions or different states or different cities react, or what sort of powers do they have to either invite school choice or reject it?
Right. A lot of the answer to that depends on what the administration or Congress proposes and does. So there have been proposals in the past. Senator Alexander is chair of the Education Committee in the Senate. He's talked about the GI Bill for kids or Pell Grants for kids. And when he's talked about that, kind of voucherizing federal K-12 money, mm-hmm. He's usually also said, but we wouldn't just say all states have to have school choice. It would be something of if a state had already voted for a school choice program. So if a state had a voucher program or maybe a scholarship tax credit program, they could then use this money as part of that. But it wouldn't require or coerce or incentivize states that don't have school choice to institute new programs. Now, so that sounds like it's still up to states and districts what they want to do. We've often heard politicians say, no, we're not trying to make you do anything. We heard this with Common Core, in fact, but part of that has been, but if you want this money that came from taxpayers who live in your state and you want to get it back, then you really do have to do what we want. In that case, it was adopt Common Core. It could be, with a proposal we might get from the Trump administration, you really do need to have a voucher program. So it's hard to say what the federal government would try and make states do. And then the other interesting regional question or state question is the reason two Republicans voted against DeVos, one was Murkowski from Alaska and the other was Collins from Maine, was saying, we like school choice, but we're very rural, and most rural areas don't have more than one school to choose from.
Now, so much of American public education seems stuck in time, and that's another conversation. I'm probably going to bring you back on for that conversation, but what are some specific models or areas where you see there being dramatic change under DeVos? So we talked about school choice, which she's going to prioritize. She'll see what she can do with that. We talked a bit about charters. How could she reinvent the landscape as far as the, if not reinvent it, just sort of, you know, impact it, the landscape as far as the intersection of education and technology, with students becoming more reliant on technology as a learning tool. And then you have this rise in homeschooling and online learning. They strike me as areas where she might be rather impactful. She might, at some stage, sort of accelerate those changes.
Right. Well, if she does stick with federalism, and really she doesn't have a whole lot of power as the education secretary to affect any of those things, other than she can use the bully pulpit. And we've seen, for instance, when Bill Bennett was the Secretary of Education, he didn't have a whole lot of power, and he used the bully pulpit to huge effect. So she could certainly go around and talk about you know, we're in the 21st century, but schools are still like a 19th century model. And you want to have more online options. You want to be able to use technology. You should be able to, if your school doesn't offer a particular class, say you want AP chemistry, you can go to another school. You might be able to do it online and take their AP chemistry. So you might have course choice. She could talk about that a lot. And that could maybe help drive states, I hope, in particular, to open up all sorts of new options. It could also lead or to contribute to a debate for federal school choice. I don't think that's a good thing. I actually think federal school choice would open up a far too dangerous avenue for lots of federal regulation of private schools. And I don't think the Constitution allows it, but she could drive more choice from the federal level. Regardless, I think the one thing that's very clear that she could help to do to transform education is use her perch, sort of the national education spokesperson, to talk about the desperate need for options for everyone, because all kids are different in myriad different ways. And that could mean, in fact, probably does mean in many cases, online education, but also choice of brick-and-mortar schools. In other words, far more options driven by the needs of each and every unique child.
And so is there any middle ground between her and her critics? We've got about a couple more minutes left. Where are some areas of commonality, despite the rancor we saw during her nomination process? How do both sides get beyond that?
Well, I really think, I mean, I can't ever say for certain what people's motives are, but I don't get the impression that either Betsy DeVos and her supporters or her detractors don't care about what happens to kids. I mean, I think everybody has other concerns. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that most people are solely motivated by what's best for kids, because we're human beings in part, and so people who are in education may also care about the quality of their employment and how much they get paid, but I don't think that means they don't care about kids. There may be people who say, look, spending more money on education would be great, but we also need money for health care and transportation and whatever families need to buy for themselves, so we can't just spend more resources on schools. That doesn't mean they don't care about kids. Mm-hmm. It means there are other concerns. So I think what we need to do, hopefully we do in a national debate on education, is say, let's not keep acting like or assuming the people we disagree with don't care about kids. Let's all accept that we do agree, care about kids. Let's treat each other, no matter what side we're on in the debate, as being good actors, and then have a calm, peaceful, non-rancorous dialogue about what we think we should do for kids and why we think maybe some other factors, maybe some other concerns and values are also important. But we've really got to get away from this idea that anyone we disagree with is evil. And I hope that Betsy DeVos's detractors will stop saying stuff like she's evil or she's ignorant or all these other sort of insults and pejorative statements, and will be willing to sit down with her and say, let's talk about how we can agree to do what's best for kids and overall society.
All right. I'm talking with Neil McCluskey, Director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Cato Institute, cato.org, for more information at Neil McCluskey on Twitter. Hey, Neil, thanks again, man. We'll be talking soon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Up next is WURD's Keaton Nichols looking back at the week in Washington and how folks outside of it reacted. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from partners like BE Strategy and from listeners like you. Go to WEAA.org for more information on how you too can contribute. Keaton Nichols is executive producer and host of The Lounge, 7 p.m. Eastern daily on WURD 900 AM in Philadelphia, our partner station, also my hometown. And he's found at Keaton D. Nichols on Twitter. Keaton, what's good?
Charles.
All right. All right. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate this. So I just wanted to kind of get a back home read on how folks reacted to this past week in Washington. It was rather contentious. It was also one of those weeks, or a rare week, but I mean, it's less than a month now into the Trump administration, where it seems as if President Trump met his match, at least in the judiciary. Is that your sense, Keaton, as far as this pushback from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on his absolutely. Immigration travel brand?
Absolutely, absolutely. And keep in mind, for the course of this, that a big part of the appeal of Donald Trump, or what Donald Trump wants you to like about him, interesting way to say that, but it's true. But what Donald Trump wants you to like about him is that he's a winner, and that even in, which he doesn't really bring up, but even in loss, he wants you to at least feel or think that you are still winning. That was a big part of him getting that voter base to jump on board with some of these absolutely ridiculous proposals. If he can just convince the American people that winning is the way to go, then of course that has some particular political clout to it. So what he was handed last night was a big L. He was handed a big loss. And more importantly, I think it was a loss that, folk kind of saw coming. This executive order, and this immigration ban, because that's exactly what it was totally unconstitutional. I never saw at any point in time federal judges kind of allowing this to pass. Excuse me. As a matter of fact, I think if a federal judge hadn't stepped up like Judge Robart did, I would have been a lot more surprised to see that than the other case. So I think it was one of those losses that actually everyone should have seen coming. But it looks bad for Trump, because even in that moment when he knew he was going to lose, he continued to perpetuate that idea that I'm a winner, this is going to go my way, and this is my presidential administration, and that's the way things go. So when he projected that type of strength and then lost, you saw the sort of, you know, as folks say, we saw the salt in his tweet last night as soon as the announcement was made in all caps, effectively saying, hey, we're going to come for you in court. You know, you're not making
you in court.
America. Or,
right.
Yeah, you're making America less safe. Mm-hmm. All in all caps, which was sort of reminiscent of the fact that he kind of felt the sting of this loss and felt that he needed to fire back. So this was a big loss for Donald Trump, not because his immigration order didn't necessarily hold up. That never really had a chance. It's a big deal. It's a big loss for Donald Trump because he lost something that he promised, at least his voters, that he was going to win. And it's probably the first of many things coming up that's going to play out like that.
You know, what's interesting is with that tweet, especially, and I'm one who, just sort of going off on a tangent here, but I'm one who hates pointing out Donald Trump's tweets, because I'm one who will argue that, you know, the more we look at this dude's Twitter feed, the more we'll be distracted from the real work that he's getting done. We'll just let that stuff sort of slide right on past us. You know, in the meantime, he's just completely changing the face of government as we know it. But that's another discussion. But what I noticed in that is that he was sort of grabbing back into some of his greatest hits from the campaign. You know, like, you know, the I'll see you in court, or the, you know, you're risking national security. And I'm wondering, will those lines, those pickup lines from the campaign trail, and once again, it's only less than a month into his administration. I mean, we got another 4 years of this to go.
Right.
Is that going to work? Is that going to work with the electorate? And I know you're on Black Talk Radio, and so I know how like a lot of Black folks are reacting. But just generally speaking, I mean, is that going to work even with his electorate?
No, it's not going to work. And for a number of reasons. Actually, last night on the program, we had a CNET reporter. His name is Terry Collins. He does really good work there for CNET. And we were talking about, you know, Twitter's fourth quarter losses. Twitter's fourth quarter gains and how they hadn't really kind of been up to snuff for where they should have been. And actually, you know, a part of Twitter's strategy to gain more followers, you know, part of that plan was, you know, having Donald Trump as president, significantly drawing attention to the website. But what Terry was saying yesterday is that, you know, other news organizations and outlets publish Donald Trump's tweets all the time, to the point where people don't even need to go on the social network to actually see them. So what I think you're seeing, or what you're going to see, is an oversaturation of these tweets. And also, especially with this most recent ruling, we're finding out that the tweets are really just words, right? Like, they're not, you know, they don't really mean too much in the grand scheme of things.
They're not
binding.
I think
you're right. The real work is behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, and so once his base sort of realizes that a lot of this rhetoric that he's been pushing is just that. It's just rhetoric, and that not a lot of these plans to build a border wall, to repeal the Affordable Care Act without a reasonable replacement, and now this immigration ban, amongst some other things, including a tough Supreme Court nomination that's going to be coming up pretty soon. I think it could be very quick before his supporters, his diehard supporters, kind of lose that base. And more importantly, it's the Republicans. The Republicans play an important role in this. The people are going to lose faith in him. We've already seen them lose faith in him. He has the lowest incoming approval rating of any president, including Bush, of a couple of administrations ago. So we know that the people are already beginning to lose that grip. It's when the Republicans officially turn their back on him that he's in real trouble.
But do his diehard detractors, are they? I guess what I'm real curious about is whether or not the diehard detractors, we talk about the diehard supporters, but the diehard detractors, the Democrats, the progressives, the folks who are still stunned and, you know, stupefied and just plain scared that he's president, are they really ready to get mobilized against this in a really kind of tangible electoral or political way? And that includes millennials as well. I wanted to get your read on that. You know, you see a lot of protests, a lot of marches, a lot of people being very loud and vocal in their angst about this administration, about this new era. But I don't see any planning taking place yet. And we have some elections even coming up this year in 2017, right across the bridge there from you in Philly, in New Jersey. It's looking like you're going to get another Republican governor, honestly. And Virginia, it looks like that the Democrat that's there now, Governor Terry McAuliffe, is going to be replaced by a Republican. So, you know, I also see a lot of bluster on the Democratic and progressive side and not a lot of planning and mobilization taking place. I mean, unless I've got something wrong or I'm missing something there. What do you say, Keaton?
I think you're pretty right about that in terms of the organization and planning aspect of this phase. I'm sorry, phase of this plan, so to speak. I don't think that that's quite as well developed quite yet, and it's something that I'm paying very close attention to as my as a millennial myself and talking to a lot of folk my age who are now becoming politically aware. And I think the awareness, in all fairness to this movement, the awareness must come before the action. Like, we don't want people just just reacting to things that they see in politics, but really taking a moment to understand how this whole system works and where things sort of come from, the sausage-making process, so to speak, the non-sexy parts of this. I think there has to be an understanding, and there has to be, I don't want to say an appreciation, but a recognition of how important local and state issues are, I think, first. Before we start thinking bigger, because, you know, right now the Democrats from a national perspective aren't all that impressive. They're still not all that impressive.
No.
There's been some antics in the Senate with these confirmation hearings that have gained the Democrats, I think, a little bit more popularity from a national level. But you're right. I mean, when you're talking about who's going to become the next governor locally here in the Delaware Valley, who's going to become the next governor of New Jersey or Virginia, we just heard this morning, that District Attorney Seth Williams is not seeking a re-election, which is, quite a shock and a surprise to a lot of people. But something to note of that, I mean, it was something we literally just talked about on the show last night. The idea that that typically these district attorney, these off-year elections draw about somewhere between like maybe 10 and 15% voter turnout, which is not a whole lot, which means that especially if you're an incumbent, you can pretty much organize the support that you need enough to get you reelected in that particular year. And all the flack that Seth Williams was facing, what he did is him and his team looked at the political environment and looked at the fact that there are people paying attention to his race, people paying attention to local races in general, and commenting on them, sharing stories, calling local offices that never did before. And I think that's a scary thing for someone who was kind of teetering on enough support to actually win his election, to the point where he did all the calculations, his team did all the calculations and said, no, we're not going to seek a reelection. And I think, and I'm pretty positive, and I can say confidently, that I think people clamoring about this more, this political process more, and holding our elected officials responsible, contributed significantly to that decision for what would have been a third-term district attorney to step down and say, "No, I don't want to seek it anymore because I want to protect my family and my image." That's huge, and that says to me that the voters are now beginning to at least organize their ideas to the point where, maybe some elected officials might be shaking a little bit in their boots.
Interesting. All right. Well, I mean, sausage making ain't easy, but it's definitely sausage making ain't sexy, but it's definitely the secret sauce, and it's what you have to know for the political process. I got less than a couple of minutes with you, Keaton. I did want to ask about Philadelphia as a sanctuary city, because it's one of those, cities that has an enormous migrant population. And so is it prepared, I guess, politically? Is this political class, is it prepared to push back against Trump administration immigration restrictions, beyond just the immigration travel ban? But, I mean, there's a lot that this new Trump Justice Department is preparing to do as far as immigration restrictions. So is Philadelphia as a city politically and also socially, culturally, is it prepared for that, to push back against that? You got a minute.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The city of Philadelphia is, we got a mayor who is very passionate about those issues. I mean, when the immigration ban was announced, executive order announcing the immigration
right.
ban. You know, the mayor's office released this very strongly worded statement against it, let people know, in the city know that, hey, I don't care what Trump says, we're going to hold on to our sanctuary city status.
Yeah.
You know, he can go ahead and pull funds from us. You know, a couple other cities across the nation kind of reacting the same way. And that's the attitude going on within the city. And Philadelphia has one of I think it's one of the top 20 cities, mm-hmm. and that might be even top 15, but for sure top 20
yeah.
cities with immigrant populations or areas, like so, say Philly, Delaware, New Jersey,
right,
Southern New Jersey,
right.
stuff like that. So this is obviously
right.
something that's very important to the area. But no, you know, Philadelphia as a city, I have full confidence that they will fight tooth and nail for the rights of the immigrants that live in the city. What I'm concerned is a situation in which state legislators and in Pennsylvania, they have a tremendous advantage, especially in the Senate, 34-16,
especially
like that.
Right,
they could maybe overturn some of those rules because
exactly.
we've seen them do it before.
Especially when that $1 trillion infrastructure package comes down the line. But
yep.
We'll see. I mean, Philly likes to brawl, but we'll see what happens during that sausage making process. Our Keaton Nichols, executive producer and host of The Lounge, catch at 7 p.m. Eastern daily on WURD 900 AM. Go to 900AMWURD.com and you can stream it live, actually.
That's right.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. At Keaton D. Nichols on Twitter. Take care, man. I'll talk to you again.
Thank you, sir.
And that wraps this week's edition of the Ellison Report. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. Big ups to Andre Melton, Tyron Rice, digital producer Ollie Post, and others at WEAA. Touch base at Ellison Report on Twitter. Continue to listen in at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. History.